Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan is hoping to implement an April 10th deadline for Syria to partially implement his peace plan with a full ceasefire within 48 hours. The UN says Syrian soldiers and security forces have killed more than 9,000 people over the past 12 months. Today's guest, Borzu Daragahi, just tweeted, "Ceasefire, helicopter gunships and tanks open fire, record numbers of refugees flood the border." Borzu Daragahi is Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, and he joins us to talk about media coverage of the ongoing violence in Syria. He's joining us from Beirut. Hi, Borzu. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
It's nice to have you. And I want to let listeners know Borzu will be with us for about 15 or so minutes. So if you'd like to call in to talk about media coverage of what's happening on the ground in Syria, now would be a good time to call 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. So Borzu, as we always do on Friday, we like to give kudos to a reporter who's doing a good job of reporting this week. I know that you've been focused mostly solely on Syria. I've been checking your tweets and Facebook page. But what have you seen this week that you thought has been done well?
Well, I thought it was an interesting story that the New Yorker, I don't know, at least it's on his website, by Seymour Hersh, it was a great scoop about this camp out in the West. I think it was in Nevada under the U.S. Department of Energy, where the anti-Iranian regime militants from the terror cult, the Mujahideen e Khalq, the MKO, this sort of sick group of activists who have been opposed to the Islamic Republic, were being trained under the Bush years. That's a must-read story, I think.
And this happened in Nevada?
Yeah, apparently under the Bush years, they were training these guys who are on the State Department's terror list to fight against the Iranian regime. It just sort of showed the extremes of the Bush administration, at least during a certain era. The program was shuttered shortly before Bush left office. This is, like I said, it's a must-read scoop by Seymour Hersh.
Oh, it sounds incredible. We'll link to that story right after the show. Thank you for that. So you are in Beirut. Before we talk about what's happening on the ground in Syria, a committee to protect journalist analysis recently found government culpability in at least 5 of the 8 journalist deaths recorded in Syria since the uprising began last year. They say that despite the risk, international and local journalists are sustaining coverage. You are in Beirut. Are you able to go to Syria, and how many international journalists are currently in Syria?
Well, no, I've not been in Syria since I snuck in briefly last year. I'm not sure exactly how many are in there. There are some, but most of them are from kind of weird outlets. Russia Today, some obscure Dutch freelance journalist. These are people who have generally a record of ideological affinity with Bashar al-Assad's regime. Mm. And those are the ones that are given visas. I applied for a visa. I emailed the guy. He didn't even get back to me. Didn't even respond because I'm a long time. I've focused, even before this uprising, I focused on the human rights situation in Syria.
And I'd like to ask you, after we talk about what's going on the ground, about this coverage, because Russia Today is getting a lot of attention for their coverage of Syria. But before we do that, the situation seems to be becoming very complicated. You've got Kofi Annan trying to work out a ceasefire deal with Syria, proposed for April 10th. Saudi Arabia and Qatar say they are going to arm the opposition. The United States says the U.S. must respond urgently if Syria does not meet this deadline. So give us a sense of just what is happening on the ground and these different propositions.
Well, look, I mean, every single time there's been some sort of diplomatic initiative in Syria over the past year, Bashar al-Assad has used that as an opportunity to step up violence So it hasn't. He sees these diplomatic initiatives as breathing space for him to physically liquidate his opponents. And, you know, I mean, quite frankly, and everyone knows this, but no one is willing to say it, at least in the diplomatic community. You know, talk of a ceasefire is absurd because Bashar al-Assad knows if there's a ceasefire, there will be millions of people out on the streets demanding his downfall. And you know, this is what everyone knows. And this is why, you know, there will never be a ceasefire in Syria so long as Bashar al-Assad is in control. He knows it will be his head if there's a ceasefire.
And the BBC just reported that the number of refugees has doubled since the UN has called for a ceasefire.
The BBC it's the Turkish authorities have been saying that, you know, over in the 24 hours, I mean, well, here's the intense number. In the 24 hours ending this morning, there was close to 3,000 people crossing the border. You know, that's an amazing number. I've been to that border. That's an amazing number of people who've managed to cross that border, which is, you know, very, very rough terrain. And it suggests some really horrible things that are happening in Syria, that many people in so short a time are making their way across the border, a more intense flood of refugees than at any other point in this year-long conflict.
And how are you getting your information from inside Syria?
I mean, there's a few. It's tough. It's really hard. I mean, there's a few mostly citizen journalists who are aligned with the opposition, who are, you know, giving information to me and other journalists. These are people I've grown to trust over the last year, more than a year now. You know, and it's flawed. It's a flawed process. I admit that. But I will tell you this: if one of these guys burns me once, that's it. Mm. And I make it clear to them that if you guys ever give me any, not only I say to the activists, look, we like you, we'll work with you. But if you ever give me any, you know, information that turns out that you were deliberately falsifying or exaggerating, not only will I not use you anymore, but I'll tell my colleagues, you know, my friends at the New York Times and the Washington Post, that you're not to be used anymore or trusted anymore. And you know, this is a little measure of a way of trying to keep people honest.
Right. I mean, we hear the same stories from reporters who are trying to get stories about Iran, for example, out during their uprising.
Yeah. I was one of those too. I had to deal with that too. And the experience of covering Iran during the uprising has helped me with Syria as well.
Right. So what are you hearing from these activists? What are they dealing with, and what message do they want you to get out to the rest of the world?
And they're people are really despondent, and they're, you know, almost hopeless about, you know, the whole message getting out to the rest of the world. At this point, you know, and this is kind of sad because it started out as such a, you know, peaceful uprising. You know, they're saying, like, you know what, we don't want any more humanitarian aid. We don't want to even talk about humanitarian aid. Just send us cash so we can buy weapons so we can fight Bashar al-Assad. And so, and that's the sort of spooky aspect of this. What started out as a peaceful, idealistic uprising is turning more and more into an armed insurgency with people, you know, instead of looking for ideas to combat a brutal, corrupt regime, they're looking for guns to fight him.
Well, we've got a caller on the opposition, so let's hear from Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger.
Yes, thank you, Rose. My question to your guest is, what is the population of Syria? I've been trying to find it here on the computer. And what does he feel are the strength of the insurgency? How many people in Syria want a change in government? I'm a bit confused that I know what happened in Iraq, and it was a mess. When the powers took over there, they simply eliminated Christians. And I'm afraid the same thing is going to happen in Syria. I'd like to know what kind of government do you think it'll be established there? Will it be something like Libya, Egypt? And sorry, I can't be more concise than this, Rose, but I think this is the heart of it. I'm not convinced that the people of Syria want a change in government. And I'd like this guest to...
And Roger, what makes you say that?
Well, I believe that population of Syria. Now, I'm just throwing this out. It's in the millions.
It's about 22 million.
I'm sorry. What did you say, Rose?
22 million.
22, 23 million.
How many of those 22 or 23 million want to change? Now, what I just can't get a grasp of that. I would like to have a democracy there. I don't believe in dictatorships. But if most of the people are not unhappy with the system they have, it's kind of dangerous to get in there and mess around like we did in other countries in the Middle East.
All right, Borzu?
Well, I don't think anyone's getting in there and messing around. I think that especially the Obama administration has been very reluctant about giving anything other than moral support to the opposition. There's been talk of giving some humanitarian aid for cities that are being bombed and hit with artillery fire. As for how much of the people support Bashar al-Assad, you know, I mean, he does have his supporters, but let's just look at the situation here and just, you know, I know Syria, I know Syrians, you know, they're normal people just like everyone else. Here's a regime that has been in power for 40 years. They've, you know, tortured and executed enemies of the state for 40 years. They've taken peaceful activists and thrown them into dungeons for decades. In some cases. And when there was a peaceful revolt against the rule of Bashar al-Assad, the government responded with, you know, machine gun fire and an intensification of these police state tactics. So I would just say to the caller, like, would you want to live in a state like that? Syrians are people, too. Mm. They have the same values that we do in many respects. I would just put it that way.
Well, how would you respond? I've been seeing a lot of Facebook posts about this, that there's a lot of meddling going on from outside forces, specifically the United States.
I think the United States is not meddling at all. And I wish the Syrian activists wish that they would meddle more. Mm. You know, I think that there is a faction of pro-Syrian activists, misguided leftists sometimes, who because of Syria's vehement opposition to Israel and U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, join, you know, the sort of propaganda brigades on behalf of the Syrian regime because they are so anti-American and so anti-Israeli, because Bashar al-Assad mouths a few slogans against Israel and the U.S. now and then, they support him as well. Mm. I think those are the people that you're seeing post those messages are those people.
Well,
misguided leftists.
Well, and that brings me to RT, because RT's coverage is getting a lot of attention on Facebook. Have you been following Russia Today's coverage of Syria, and what's your assessment of it?
I think the Russia Today is like just crazy propaganda. I read Russian, English language Russian media for laughs. I'm not watching it closely because I have too much work, but I can tell you I watched it closely during the Libya uprising, and it was a joke. You know, they were so supportive of Gaddafi. Look, you know, I mean, let's forget about Russia Today. Look at Russia. Russia does not see Syria as anything other than a piece on the chessboard, and they don't want the U.S. They see Syria as part of their sphere of influence. They don't want Russia. They don't want Syria to go into the American sphere of influence. So that's their main concern. They don't really care about the fate of the Syrian people. And as for the Syrian people's democratic aspirations, well, look at, you know, Russia and how it treats the democratic aspirations of its own people.
We have a question from a listener. Do journalists pay activists in Syria for information?
Never.
Okay. Never. And so what about Borzu? Where does the coverage go from here? I mean, what is your... What sort of information are you trying to get from here? Where do you think this is going? Well, do you think the killing will continue? According to the UN,
yeah,
we've got 9,000 people so far killed.
Yeah, I think the killing will continue. I think it will go on for years and years. Mm-hmm. This sort of thing will not end easily. I mean, Syrian society has been cracked. It's been torn asunder by this whole issue. And the response of the security forces has been so bloody and so over the top that, you know, the people... You know, imagine yourself, you know, you're a student activist, you're a, you know, young man, and you've watched your brother, your father, your best friends being shot and killed and jailed and tortured by this regime. Are you going to be like, well, you know, I guess that's the breaks. Now I'm going to go and make my peace with this regime. Probably not. You're probably going to say, you know, if I give up now, their loss will have been in vain. So I'm going to keep on fighting.
Well, Borzu, what story are you working on right now?
With regard to Syria, not much. Perhaps something on campus activism, how students throughout Syria are increasingly taking to the streets and you know, taking the sort of peaceful protests into the very heart of the capital and other major cities, which have been somewhat tranquil so far.
Well, thank you so much, Borzu. Thanks for your reporting, and we'll be following it closely.
It's my pleasure.
All right, thank you. That is Borzu Dargahi. He is Middle East correspondent with the Financial Times, joining us from Beirut, and you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. And it's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we're going to switch gears now to talk about two recent federal crackdowns in the United States. Today's guest, David Downs, reports that an unprecedented federal raid at Oaksterdam University this week may become a public relations windfall for the pot legalization movement. On Monday morning, U.S. Marshals packing clips of automatic rifle rounds stood guard alongside armed Internal Revenue Service and Drug Enforcement Administration agents underneath the well-known Oaksterdam University sign at 1600 Broadway in Oakland. And Oaksterdam University is a cannabis college. And we'll be talking about what exactly Oaksterdam University does. David Downs is a freelance journalist and a contributing writer for the East Bay Express, and he joins us in studio. Hi, David. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Rose. I really appreciate it.
Great to have you. And during a six-day nationwide crackdown last week, 3,168 undocumented immigrants were arrested. It was the largest amount since crackdowns began in 2009 by Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agents, or ICE. And joining us to talk about this is Valeria Fernandez. She's an independent journalist and co-producer of the new documentary film, Two Americans. And Valeria joins us from Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, Valeria. Welcome to the show. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. So we've got two major, major federal crackdowns in the last two weeks. David, let's start off with you. Just give us an overview of what took place in Oakland on Monday. You say that this was actually 6 months in the making.
Sure. In October of last year, four U.S. attorneys here in California pretty much declared war on the medical marijuana industry. They were saying that it got out of hand and that they were going to begin prosecutions against medical marijuana businesses as opposed to patients or individual caregivers. You know, and over the last 6 months, we've seen hundreds of forfeiture letters go out to marijuana business landlords threatening to seize their property if they continue to rent to these businesses. And subsequently, most of those landlords have evicted a lot of their marijuana businesses, and they've quietly gone under. What happened on Monday was sort of the first real crystal public example of the crackdown in effect. We had, you know, a number of agents from various federal agencies, you know, standing guard underneath the Oaksterdam University sign blocking access to mere information about the plant, and, you know, 50 to 100 demonstrators there Monday morning taunting them and telling them to go away and telling them a shame. Most of the major media in the region was in the area as well, capturing photos, which went out across the wires and across the internet. Monday was the lead story Monday morning until the shooting happened. And it's going to turn into a poster for the pot legalization movement going forward.
And a lot of media were there capturing what went down. There were dramatic photos in the Chronicle, incredible video on YouTube of all of this.
That's correct. The East Bay and Northern California's medical marijuana legalization community is really prepared for these types of raids. And when it started happening early Monday morning around 8 o'clock, word went out across Twitter and Facebook to rally at these locations with signs and bring cameras and capture sort of federal overreach.
I've been trying to, looking through the coverage, trying to find just the amount in dollars in terms of the resources the government is putting into this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know at this point?
Some ex-law enforcement officers are estimating that, you know, it's in the tens of thousands of dollars to prepare for a raid like this, mm-hmm. and then tens of thousands of dollars to execute it in terms of bringing in dozens of agents from the IRS, DEA, and U.S. Marshals to secure these facilities and take possession of their property.
And so the media were there grabbing the photos and the video, interviewing people. There was a photo in the Chronicle of a woman getting high during the raid. After this happened, did you find a good analysis piece looking at what the end game is for the federal government here?
You know, a lot of people immediately started scratching their heads going, what was the federal government thinking? And myself and other journalists are starting to think that they weren't really thinking. They were just sort of following a procedure. They have had some issues with Oaksterdam in the past, and they were moving forward with enforcement against him. But they really gave a public relations windfall to the legalization community.
What are the challenges of journalists covering a crackdown like this?
The challenges are trying to get information out of the federal government. They said that the search warrant was under seal and that they had no further comment, which sort of immediately starts a process of guessing as to why they're there. And those guesses continue to this day. The warrant's still under seal.
And Valeria, what are the challenges for journalists in covering ICE crackdowns?
Well, there's always in Arizona, it's pretty much where we have a three-quarter raid every day, but it's not necessarily connected with the federal government. So, you know, you typically hear about this from people in the community. You get updates. They, you know, ICE doesn't announce it. And there's always a certain degree of confusion because it's unclear whether or not this is just a raid on the business from Sheriff Joe Arpaio, or if this is, you know, if it's some other thing that has nothing to do with immigration. So initially there's a little bit of confusion. And, of course, we always in general face a difficulty in getting, you know, the federal government to talk to us. You know, there's always the issue of confidentiality. And even if you have a specific case with a name, it's a really complicated process to get them to address the particular case.
And what was your assessment of media coverage of last week's six-day raid conducted by 1,900 ICE agents in 50 states, resulting in the arrest of 68 undocumented immigrants? The New York Times reports that, quote, among those detained were 1,477 immigrants who had served prison sentences for felonies, 1,063 with more than one criminal conviction, and some are considered a threat to national security. I saw this sentence over and over in a number of articles, and I just, what is a threat exactly to national security in this instance?
Wow, that's a really, I think it's a difficult question to answer. I mean, they're talking about that most of these people had been convicted several times, and that they had, they were playing sort of a game with the immigration system. But I think they're bulking, you know, to say that they're all of these people are a threat to national security. You know, that implies sort of terrorism. And based on the information that they put out there, some of these people have been committed of crimes. They committed offenses towards the community. But it has a much broader implication to say that they were a threat. And 559 of these people were immigrants that were deported and came back through the border and re-entered the country again. So it would be very interesting to find out what are the stories of these 559 people. Mm. As we see in Arizona, it's very common for our law enforcement to arrest and detain and turn people to immigration authorities. These are members of a community that have ties, that have families here, and we see it every day. They find a way to come back, and I'm sure that a lot of them are in this list of 559 people.
And that is Valeria Fernandez. She's an independent journalist joining us from Tucson, Arizona. We're also joined by David Downs, freelance journalist and contributing writer for the East Bay Express. And we're talking about media coverage of two federal crackdowns in the last week. Monday, the feds raided Oaksterdam University. That's a cannabis college. And then last week, there was a six-day raid conducted by 1,900 ICE agents, resulting in the arrest of over 3,100 undocumented immigrants. And if you saw pieces on these crackdowns, what are your thoughts? Did you see good analysis pieces of these crackdowns? And if there was another story you saw that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also post your article at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
K KALW has been broadcasting at 91.7 on the FM dial in the Bay Area since 1941. Now with online listening, KALW has listeners worldwide. But just because you live in the Bay Area doesn't mean KALW's online streams aren't for you. If you hear KALW at work but maybe not at home or lose reception on your commute, check out the online listening options at KALW.org. Whether you're on the desktop, your tablet, or smartphone, you can stay connected. Just click the Listen Live link at the top of KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we'll have a conversation about the realities of being a person of color in the United States. This issue is getting a lot of attention in the national media because of the killing of Trayvon Martin. So what forms of discrimination do people face? How are communities of color dealing with these realities? And how are they also dealing with violence? That's Monday. We're also putting a show together next week about the tax proposals on the November ballot in California. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our weekly media roundtable, and we are talking today about media coverage of the major federal crackdowns that have happened in the last 2 weeks. On Monday, there was an unprecedented federal raid at Oaksterdam University. Today's guest, David Downs, says it might become a PR windfall for the pot legalization movement. David Downs is a freelance journalist and contributing writer for the East Bay Express. And then last week, there was a six-day ICE crackdown. 3,168 undocumented immigrants were arrested. It was the largest arrest since crackdowns began in 2009, and we're talking about coverage of that with Valeria Fernandez, an independent journalist who is out with a new documentary called Two Americans, and you can find a link to that documentary at yourcallradio.org. And we have a caller on the medical marijuana raid. Let's hear from Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid.
I never use marijuana. The strongest drug I use is hot tea. But really, I am very, very, very disappointed at the coverage and also at Obama. Well, this election year, so he's trying to show how tough he is. But the media never discuss what the issue of drugs in general. The U.S. only concedes 5% of the world population. In fact, less than 5%. The U.S. population uses more than 60% of illicit drugs. We, among the other people, and you know, including people like Bill Rothenberg and the rest, very conservative people, we are pushing for legalizing, or at least decriminalizing drugs. Because what do you have? I wish if this 100 agents went down to the streets of Oakland, other places where young kids killing one another, you know, for the same thing that this office was selling. And the fact, it really come to personal freedom. I mean, when is enough is enough is enough. I mean, Obama have failed me personally as far as my business, where he gave all of this money to the banks. He's in the hand of the Wall Street, of the warmongers, of the new conservatives, of the new, of the theocons. The man does nothing for this country except continuing destruction as George Bush started. And
well,
really, we need to stand, all of us, to stand for America like America's pause in the 60s, 70s, 80s.
Well, Eid, thank you for your question, and I'm glad you brought this up, about where is the coverage of the larger issue about drugs. And Mexican President Felipe Calderon was in the U.S. at the White House on Monday. He said that drug violence would continue unabated in Mexico unless the flow of guns is curbed and unless the United States deals with the demand in the United States for drugs. David, are you seeing there? So there's two interesting things going on right now. The media have a really good opportunity to really dive into this issue with the crackdown on Monday and then Felipe Calderon being at the White House also on that same day.
Yeah, and as someone who tries to monitor everything that's being written about cannabis, marijuana, whatever you want to call it, I have seen coverage that has been substantial on the Oaksterdam University raid, whether it's Chip Johnson in the San Francisco Chronicle saying that this is a waste of federal resources, to the Chronicle editorial board saying that we don't know what Obama's thinking with this. There's a lot better priorities for him. The Los Angeles Times has really, over the last year, begun to pay attention to more of the nuances of the medical marijuana debate here in California, and recently did a very lengthy, very wide-eyed, very uncritical piece on what just the culture is around cultivation in Oakland, and, you know, interviewed a lot of people who went to Oaksterdam. The New York Times, Time Magazine, a lot of these places have grown up over the last year or two about covering this and have moved away from making snarky little puns and jokes about potheads and started to dive into the very real issue of the fact that we have the highest incarceration rate in the world. And it's not seeming to abate. There's this schism between people who care about about this issue and the writing about it, where sometimes I feel like they're not connecting with each other, but there is quite a bit being written about it. If you want to look, but I do see personally people writing me and saying, you know, where is the coverage of this, and referencing, you know, how off base Obama is, and it's out there. So,
and Ron Paul was in town this week at Berkeley, and he got a wild applause talking about the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just like to add that it's not an intuitive issue, and it's a very complex one. So, for example, there was a real big sort of meeting of Latin American countries recently on drug policy, where a lot of them said, we're tired of doing this. Mm-hmm. And it's not working, and we're thinking of going a separate way. And the legalization community really wanted the media and me to write about it. But in terms of priorities, it was one of those ones, you know, that inevitably gets shoved in the back for the next school shooting or the budget or that kind of thing.
Well, it seems like there will be more coverage this year. Reuters reported that 16 states and the District of Columbia have legalized the use of medical marijuana. Federal authorities have also intensified their crackdowns in Colorado and Washington, where voters will be deciding in November whether to make those states the first to legalize marijuana for recreational use. And then Arizona's governor just signed a law banning marijuana from college campuses. So there's a lot going on across the country on this issue.
I believe Massachusetts is looking at a medical marijuana bill. California is really not going to have anything going on in 2012 in terms of initiatives, but Colorado and Washington stand a really good chance of legalizing adult use of marijuana in 2012, and we're going to see a lot of press around that. There's a lot of hooks to this story. There's also a lot of local initiatives happening across California in terms of, like, places like sleepy little towns like Palo Alto are going to be voting to regulate and open dispensaries this November.
Hmm. And so thank you for the call, Ed. And we'll put links to a couple of the stories that David just mentioned at yourcallradio.org. And we have another question about the Oaksterdam raid from Mary Jane in San Francisco. Hi, Mary Jane.
Hi there, Rose. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
One of my concerns is that, you know, the federal government multi-funds the Drug Enforcement California Police. So when a person is going on a raid like this, an official, a drug enforcement, they are multi-funded. Now, the ones in California are supposed to be supporting medical marijuana, but they opt. They have a choice. They opt to support the federal point of view. And this presents a big problem. And my brother was a cannabis doctor, and the officers, the police, brought charges against him for prescribing medical marijuana or authorizing medical marijuana, and the medical board brought charges against him. So his patients went on trial to support him, so their patient ABC. It was clear they look normal, but you never know what problems they have. And so this is a part of the misinformation. If you're going to have this security between the doctor and the patient, the people in the police go around picking up these people because they look normal or they give the appearance and they have a normal job, but they have other issues that may not be apparent to the officers. So it's the multi-funding and the officers making medical judgments about the patients that are a problem in California, especially going raiding dispensaries and who raids them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Jane. I think she brings up a good point, which is that, you know, a lot of times the media in California will just say, oh, there's such a gray area. There's so much ambiguity. It's so hazy about marijuana in California. And they can do more to investigate that ambiguity. The reality is that criminal justice is based on a large amount of discretion. And in California, police officers, law enforcement officers, have a wide latitude of discretion depending on which jurisdiction they're in when it comes to enforcing or not enforcing cannabis laws. And we've seen, District Attorney George Gascon here in San Francisco reaffirm his commitment to supporting medical marijuana in the dispensaries. And we've seen the DA of Los Angeles, Mr. Steve Cooley, say that dispensaries are illegal and sales are illegal, and we're going to be raiding these guys and putting them out of business. And, you know, the average citizen who's trying to get through their day and has a lot on their plate can't really parse that contradiction and doesn't understand how hazy it is, so to speak, and what is sort of the facets of that ambiguity.
All right. Well, thank you, Mary Jane. And I also wanted to mention that Richard Lee, Oaksterdam University founder, recently announced that he's going to step down.
Yeah.
And he's the guy who's been instrumental in really pushing for ballot measures to legalize marijuana.
Yeah.
He says it's time for other people to take over.
Yeah, the LA Times reported that last night at 9:30 on their blog, and it's sort of making the rounds today. It is officially the day five story of the Oaksterdam raid is Rich Lee stepping down now. He said he's stepping down, but the businesses are supposed to stay open. More power to whoever would attempt to run them in his absence after such a big target has been painted on their backs. He also said that he's going to continue to campaign for legalization. He has a big brand, as a name. He can sort of step back away from the reins of power at these organizations and just be a voice, and he will continue to do so. But as he said to the LA Times, he's been fighting for this for 20 years. He's a little tired. It's time for him to sit back, because he's facing serious federal drug charges.
That is David Downs. He is a contributing writer for the East Bay Express, and he covered this week's raid at Oaksterdam University. And we're also joined by independent journalist Valeria Fernandez. And we're talking to Valeria about last week's ICE raid, which resulted in over 3,000 arrests of undocumented immigrants. And we've got about 15 minutes left. We'd love to hear from you if you've got any questions or comments about media coverage of these two crackdowns. They've been getting extensive coverage. And if there was another story that you saw this week that you'd like to bring to our attention, we'd love to hear from you. And also, did you see much attention about Felipe Calderon's visit to the White House and the words that were exchanged between Felipe Calderon and Barack Obama about drugs and violence in Mexico and the demand for drugs in the U.S. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Valeria, did you see, have any reporters asked President Obama specifically about last week's ICE raid? I haven't seen him quoted about that anywhere.
I haven't seen anything about that. But locally, Arizona is such a place where we have a lot of discussion about what the state law enforcement is doing and the federal government has done. There's been just a lot of discussion about the difference between this type of sweeps conducted by the federal government and what we've seen by local agencies like Sheriff Joe Arpaio's. And there's been an attempt by the local people from ICE to really emphasize that they were going after convicted criminals, that this is a shift in their priorities. And it also has spurred a lot of conversation because, as you know, the federal government has launched this directive about prosecutorial discretion, which means that they were going to review about 300,000 cases of people that are, in the process of deportation and reassess their ties to the country, for how long they've been here, whether or not they have a U.S. citizen family, and allow them to stay or not. And so these sort of incidents spark a lot of discontent among groups that want to see more movement on the prosecutorial discretion front. I think recently Secretary Morton testified that from these 300,000 cases, only about 11,000 were reviewed, and only 1,000 were granted the possibility to stay here in the country. So it's sort of a stark contrast to see what they're doing in one way or in another, and you have to see it too in the larger context of, this electoral year. And also, let's not forget that this month, on April 25th, the Supreme Court is going to be discussing sort of the future of SB 1070, a state law
that made it a crime to be here without papers. And that has a lot to do, I mean, the federal government sued Arizona because of that. So this is very timely in the sense that they're trying to show that, look, we're doing something. The federal government is prioritizing. We're going after the, these are priorities. We're going after the hardened criminals, those that are convicted. And we don't want the states to sort of steer us in a different direction.
Well, a listener just sent over an article by Color Lines that says less than three half of the 3,000 detained in the ICE sweeps convicted of felonies. And Color Lines looked at ICE's own numbers and found that some, a lot of these people are wanted for murder, for example, but about 700 are counted as criminals whose violation is that they fail to leave the country after they've been ordered to do so. 559 were, quote, illegal reentrants, people who'd been deported but have returned, as you said earlier.
Yes, exactly. There's those 559. We're talking about people that maybe they were detained in a traffic stop, they get deported, they want to come back. There's situations that, you know, sometimes their children are left here. They don't have family member to take care of them. They're with their neighbors. And, you know, that process and that desperation of getting back, you know, I've seen it firsthand. People make a lot of really bad decisions in the haste to come back. And they get caught. They get caught. You know, they just simply try to hide in vehicles or they borrow somebody documents and, you know, for that need of coming. But the other thing is the fugitives. That's really important, too. There's a number in there that Color Line is referring to. When they say fugitives, fugitives sounds like a really scary word, but we're talking about people that a judge ordered for them to leave the country. These were people that not necessarily came here as undocumented immigrants, but they were in the process in the court, in the immigration court system, to gain somewhat immigration documentation, or they were, you know, looking for political asylum. There were some issues maybe with, you know, a crime that they committed that disqualified them in the immigration process. And when they receive letters from the court saying you need to leave by X date, a lot of time people ignore those letters and they stay and ICE goes to pick them up. Sometimes they don't get them because they moved. But it's really important to understand how complex is this immigration system and that there's a lot of people caught in the net that are not necessarily the convicted criminals that the government is referring to in that press release. When you start looking at the specific cases, I was just covering one about someone that for 7 years been trying to get political asylum. He fears for his life. He doesn't want to return to Mexico because of all the violence over there. And he just got a letter, you know, that he needs to go back. Mm. And, you know, that person is going to return. But I've seen it in cases of people that were victims of fraud by immigration, you know, people posing as immigration attorneys. They filed the wrong paperwork. They became witnesses in these cases, you know, sort of blue-collar cases. And at the end of that process, you know, the federal government says, you know, we're convicted and you're done. Now you need to leave. So they show for their regular appointment with immigration, and they're arrested right there at the spot. So it's a lot of different things going on.
Right, and a lot of very personal stories. We have a comment on our website from Mike, who says 3,500 arrested by ICE while Attorney General Eric Holder goes after Arizona County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Is this just a commercial war being waged by an attorney general who's appearing to be doing nothing more or less than procuring incarceration income for the Corrections Corporation of America? And just for some background, the Obama administration last Tuesday, actually this Tuesday, said it was preparing to sue Arizona County Sheriff Joe Arpaio and his department for violating civil rights laws by improperly targeting Latinos in a big bid to crack down on undocumented immigrants.
Well, I think we need to remember that the civil rights investigation with the DOJ started in the previous administration, the Bush administration and the sheriff's office. So it's been going on for quite a while, and the findings were presented last December, which they were saying that the sheriff's office was engaging in racial profiling and so forth and so forth. So they gave the sheriff some time to do negotiations to see if he would be willing to implement some reform in his agency. I mean, they I am paraphrasing them, but they were talking about a sort of abuse and violation of civil rights that is sort of systematic. There is a pattern of practice, and that goes all the way to the top. It's coming from the leadership. So that's where the Department of Justice is coming from. The Sheriff Joe Arpaio has said that this is political, it's an election year, but it's very important to put it into context that these investigations sort of started because the community in Arizona, including elected officials from different parties, really banged the doors of the Department of Justice and said, you need to come and take a look at what's going on here. Now, on the other side, I think that it's clear, and we've seen it through the years, the timing for this sort of federal sweeps, it's very interesting in the context of everything else that is going on. And it's clear that the Obama administration is, you know, trying to walk in the difficult line of trying to prove that, listen, we're doing our job.
Yeah.
The federal government is taking care of this. Leave it up to us.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, Valeria, because when I was checking out local coverage of the sweeps, the local papers did a good job and talked about, you know, 50 in Utah, 55 in this part of Florida. And in almost every article, the Obama administration got kudos from the Republicans in that district.
Well, that is very interesting. It seems like they're having a desired effect. it seems like, you know, these worked in the way that they were expecting, you know, to sort of prove that point.
And David, you wanted to jump in there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I've noticed reading a lot of the comments to the media coverage on the crackdown, and I just got an email today personally about someone who referenced both immigration and the crackdown in the same email, which is that Obama's really, I mean, I hate to use the phrase damned if you do, damned if you don't here. A lot of people are saying he looks weak on pot and this is why he's cracking down. And some people are saying he looks weak on immigration. And this is why he's cracking down. And, you know, but his base is saying, why are you bothering these people or, you know, both sort of groups? And, you know, it's all being cast within the frame of the upcoming election. And, you know, that's just fascinating to me.
And so what if you were to write about that, what frame would you use in terms of these two crackdowns and the connection to the upcoming election?
Well, I mean, everyone's sort of reading the tea leaves, you know, Obama's weak on medical marijuana, Obama's weak on immigration, and yet I believe Obama's, you know, rounded up something like 400,000 illegal immigrants and deported them, like the most of any administration ever.
Are those the right numbers, Valeria?
Yeah, it's right around that number.
400,000.
Yeah, started.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And similarly, the medical marijuana community says that he's worse than Bush. For example, the Berkeley Patients Group in Berkeley has been around since 2001 and survived the Bush administration. And it looks like they're going to be kicked out of Berkeley or forced to move around Berkeley under the Obama administration. And so people are sort of scratching their head. If there is an attempt to assuage the middle or the right with these things, I don't think it's going to do that. I think it's going to alienate the left more, and it's not going to convince the people on the right or the middle that Obama's their friend at all. And in fact, I got an email today from someone in Phoenix going, he's interfering with our program to round up these undocumented immigrants. How dare he, you know?
400,000, Valeria, that's a huge number. What would your story look like if you were to write about these two raids and their connection to the election?
Well, I think that I will actually focus on another incident that happened here of civil disobedience with a number of undocumented kids that blocked the street. And they prove a point that when the cameras are focusing on this administration, they were unwilling to take them into custody because they don't want to take this sort of kids, you know, their students. Some of them have degrees, master's degrees. But when the cameras are not there, the story is completely different of what the administration has done. And it has been cracking down much more than the previous administration, like they were saying. So I think I will take a look at what happens when the cameras are not paying attention.
We have another question from Halberst on our website saying, I'm wondering why the story regarding both illegal immigration and marijuana isn't how federal laws are violated so openly. He says the pot thing, or she, the pot thing is just out of hand. I think I'm like most Californians who are okay with real medical use, but picking up any free weekly newspaper, the whole back section is full of ads for pot doctors with pictures of marijuana leaves in the ads. Seriously, if this were doctors that advertised any other drug that way, they would have been arrested a long time ago. Imagine a morphine doctor with a big syringe in the ads. Oaksterdam University, it's just adding to the instability in Oakland that gives the image that the city is out of control. He says the storyline is... should be the opposite. What are your thoughts, David?
Well, I mean, federal laws are violated openly here in California. And, you know, people feel very passionately that everybody who's an undocumented immigrant needs to go. And there's a lot of Americans that would disagree and say that they made it here and they're serving their communities and they're doing the best they can. And it's pretty counterproductive to spend all the money we're going to spend to ship them over just to bring them back. I feel the sort of same counterproductive argument could be leveled against the sort of drug war. Here we are 70 years into it with more use and less stability than when we started. And you know, more people in prison than ever before. And then we're printing money to keep them there now. So it's making a lot of people scratch their head.
The AP has an incredible article called Addicted to Pain. Pill sales soar across U.S. fueling addiction. Sales of the nation's two most popular prescription drugs, prescription painkillers, have exploded. The increases have coincided with a wave of overdose deaths, pharmacy robberies, and other problems in New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, Florida. Opioid pain relievers, oxycodone and hydrocodone, caused 14,800 overdose deaths in 2008 alone.
Sure.
And the death rate is rising drastically.
Sure, that's four World Trade Centers a year, but we don't see a similar reaction to that type of behavior.
I had no idea they were so high.
It's higher than road deaths in many states now, by far.
So we're talking about oxycodone,
Vicodin, all the opioids, really. And the DEA has begun to move aggressively against sort of what we would call like pill factories.
Well, there was a crackdown at Walgreens.
Walgreens in Florida right now. They realize that they're exposed on that front.
Fascinating.
And they've begun to move against that.
And what are you working on right now, David?
I just finished a story for the Sacramento News and Review looking at the 2012 California initiative season vis-a-vis medical marijuana regulation. I think on Election Day 2010, when Prop 19 failed, a lot of people thought, oh, well, we got 46.4% of the vote. We lost by 400,000 votes. We're going to roll it into next year. And it turns out that none of that really happened in 2012. It was a total wash, and the reasons behind it are really fascinating.
All right, we'll look for that. And Valeria, you just finished your documentary. Congratulations, and we've got a link to Two Americans. Valeria Fernandez is an independent journalist in Phoenix, Arizona, and David Downs is contributing writer for the East Bay Express. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What are the realities of being a person of color in the U.S.? On the next Jour Call, we'll have a conversation about racial disparities. This issue is getting a lot of attention because of the killing of Trayvon Martin. What forms of discrimination do people of color experience? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. How are communities of color dealing with racial profiling and violence? And how are you discussing these issues within your communities? It's Jour Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.